From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we're talking about the photographer Robert Mapplethorpe. His explicitly sexual pictures became a part of the culture wars of the 1980s. Mapplethorpe died of AIDS in 1989, but his work continues to challenge and inspire. The director Andy Timoner's film about Mapplethorpe premiered at Sundance this year. It's being screened tomorrow night. Timoner will join us to talk about the portrait she's created of a man constantly flirting with self-destruction. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Next Wednesday, we're wrapping up our speaker series about diversity in America, and we'll have with us Maria Hinojosa. You can join us next Wednesday at the University of Utah's S.J. Quinney College of Law. For tickets and information, go to our website, KUER.org. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Robert Mapplethorpe never did see most of the controversy over his explicit homoerotic S&M photographs. A few months after he died of AIDS in 1989, the Corcoran Gallery in Washington, D.C. canceled an exhibition of his work. They were worried about losing funding from the NEA. And not long after that, a gallery in Cincinnati was charged with obscenity for showing the pictures. Mapplethorpe didn't live to see the part he played in the culture wars of the 80s, but he probably knew it was coming. In a new film by the director Andy Timoner, we see Mapplethorpe's uncompromising attitude about his work, and not just about the graphic subject matter of bondage and sex, but also his commitment to light and what he saw as beauty and honesty. Timoner's film is called Mapplethorpe. It won the Grand Jury Prize at Sundance this year. It's the second she's received at the festival. She's coming to Utah next week. The Utah Film Center is screening Mapplethorpe tomorrow night. We'll give you details about that a little bit later on the program. Timoner will also be joining us after our film series screening tonight. We're going to be showing Madeline Olnick's film about Emily Dickinson, and we'll talk to both of them about the challenges of making films about historical figures. Andy Timoner is a filmmaker, director of films like Dig and We Live in Public. She joined us from her home in Los Angeles. I should also offer a warning. Some of the clips from the film we're playing and just the subject matter of the film may not be for everyone, certainly not for your kids. Okay, so I wanted to start with the first line of an article I read from earlier this month about the film. And it reads this way. You could say Andy Timoner has a thing for problematic men. What do you think about that? This idea that you have a thing for problematic men. Is it true?
I think I have a thing for impossible visionaries. Yeah. I have a thing for people that take on the impossible and are generally brush up against society in doing so and really have to kind of withstand a lot of doubt and ridicule and stick to their guns because they see something that we can't at the time. So yes, they act impossibly, a little bit, and they could be called problematic. I think a lot of great artists are called problematic. I'm always trying to inspire audiences to step out of line a little bit in their own lives and pursue their passions, whether they feel that they're flawed or not, you know, whatever the case may be, if they have an idea to kind of go for it and I want my work to give them permission to do so. And so with Robert Mapplethorpe, I wish that I was doing more women though, because there are plenty of impossible visionary women.
You mentioned that a lot of these so-called impossible visionaries, they see something before we do. What was it the thing do you think Robert Mapplethorpe was seeing before others were?
Well, he was raised Catholic and raised in a very, quote, perfect 50s environment. And, you know, his father was a hobbyist photographer and would take family photos of, you know, and thought he had like a dark room in the basement. And he would take these perfect pictures, you know, perfectly centered and with the American flag and with the birthday cake and the whole thing. And Robert, right. He was interested in what we weren't looking at and what we couldn't see when we looked at Jesus Christ. Maybe he was interested in the sex. He was interested in the gore. He was interested in the blood and the, you know, and ultimately, once he discovered a camera, once he was handed a Polaroid, it was almost like grabbing onto a tiger's tail, and it led him into this underworld where, you know, he found himself drawn. And it was, I mean, he was lured in, and suddenly he, you know, this kind of spurring on of his artistic pursuit that he and Patty kind of did for each other. They were almost like lone wolves in New York, and then, you know, really supported each other into becoming the artists that they became. But the irony was that as he discovered himself as an artist, he also discovered his sexuality. And so he saw this beauty in gay life that was not acceptable at that time. It was deemed obscene, and he was determined to show us all the sculpture and the form and the grace and the beauty that he saw, so that maybe we would learn to love that world, and in so doing, love him.
I confess it did occur to me to ask you a question that you get asked a lot. Is this a movie or is this a documentary? And you've talked about how when you hear people ask you that question, then in some ways you don't really get it, that the distinction in some way doesn't make sense to you. Explain that to me, that you're kind of baffled by the way people see a distinction there.
It's language, right? Is it a narrative? Yeah. Is it a feature? Is it a movie, or is it a documentary, or is it a drama, or is it dramatic? You know, these words, they all apply to movies that are about real life as well. They all apply to documentary. I mean, they better have a narrative. They're often feature length, and they should be dramatic. I'd like to think that some of my movies are pretty dramatic and suspense driven. I mean, when I set out to make documentaries, I set out to make them unfolding and really to entertain people so that they were taken with the story, and then they could, from there, they could learn and learn to lose their judgment and lose their sometimes unperceived prejudices. So, which, by the way, as a documentary filmmaker, and why I do love making documentaries, even though it's painful, it's really painful. Yeah. But the reason why I love it is because I actually get this. I get to realize that I have these preconceived notions that I didn't even know I had, and then they fall away as I learn, and I try to take the audience on a similar journey.
Well, I wanted to ask, you've been working on this project, this idea for a long time, but you never really wanted to do a documentary about Robert Mapplethorpe. Explain that. What do you mean? You saw this always as being a scripted film.
Yeah, I don't tend to make films about people that aren't here anymore. I was interested in bringing Robert Mapplethorpe alive. I was interested in creating an anthem for artists. What drew me to Robert Mapplethorpe was that he took on the impossible and really at a crucial time in history. And he also made photography a collectible art form. I mean, you know, as a documentary filmmaker for many, many years myself, and somebody who just takes thousands of photographs all the time, the idea that they would be devalued or that they wouldn't be considered art, you know, is something I can't conceive of because I'm alive right now. But if you think about Robert Mapplethorpe coming up and trying to go and doing all these collages and paintings and learning to draw and being at Pratt and kind of keeping one foot in, you know, an ROTC to keep his family happy, and then just realizing I just can't do this, and finding a camera, only to realize that what he was creating with this camera, which he felt was as revelatory as Rodin or Michelangelo, was not going to make it onto the floor of the Met. That was not okay with him, you know, and that wasn't acceptable. So he just never took no for an answer. And I wanted to bring that spirit alive. I also wanted to bring that, sort of unflinching, uncompromising character alive. And
Let me ask you about the relationship you had and the conversations you had with Matt Smith as you were working this film out, as you were directing him, discussing the presentation. One of the things you've talked about is how Matt Smith is pretty insistent, as probably some actors are, about, like, he wants to understand the motivations or the moments, or he doesn't really want to act it. So I'm just interested in the conversations you had about Robert Mapplethorpe as you were making the film.
Well, I loved working with Matt Smith. And, you know, we cast Matt many years ago. My son actually recommended Matt because he was a huge Doctor Who fan, and I thought that was a crazy idea at the time. And then 2 weeks later, like, Matt's agents called and asked if I would have lunch with him, and I thought, this is kind of this weird serendipitous thing, and maybe I should just go down there and check it out. And there he was, and he was so different than the Doctor Who character, and he was just really bubbling over with this kind of quiet tension. He was very mercurial in the room, and I felt he was very much like the character that I'd written in script after script after script. So of Robert, I mean, no matter what scenes I picked out, I could see Matt in that role somehow. But I wanted to check it out, so I asked him to read. He read, which he would probably never do today. I can't imagine he would read anymore. This is like 5 years ago. Right. And and it was just jaw-dropping, his reading. It was just incredible. But nothing could have prepared me for what he brought to the screen. And more than anything, you know, what we talked about was just whether or not we were going to soften him, how we were going to soften him, whether we, you know, what was his motivation, and was he a serial lover? Why did he sleep with everybody that he photographed, pretty much, or vice versa? You know, what was that need to possess? Did it become predatorial? But Matt is very internal, and that's part of what makes him so great and makes him so perfect to play Robert. He holds a lot in, and it was more about our rapport and him feeling safe and that safe with me, and that he could play and he could try new things and try different things, but that he also had enough respect for my intelligence and my artistry that he would give me what I want. It would come down to Matt and I having very, very intense debates and very intense kind of conversations when a line would come up in the script that he didn't understand why I wrote it, and what I was going for. And oftentimes I would be completely malleable to, you know, the script is a blueprint. What would you say? You know, and we would have that discussion. Or sometimes I really needed that line to be said and I would fight for it. And it was just like that. It's just like any, you know, I think documentary filmmaking really prepared me for this, especially the film with Russell Brand, another Brit, another very, very smart Brit, who challenged me every step of the way. And if I could go toe to toe in the moment and I could prove that I was right there, right, able to just stay in the fight, and make really rational explanations instantly, I could get what I needed. And that's kind of how it worked. So I think if you're not fast on your feet with Matt, it might be a problem. You know, he's very smart. He's a very intelligent man, as was Russell. So Russell was great training. And documentary filmmaking is so much about that too. It's about negotiating really in the moment for what you need for the narrative. And as a doc filmmaker, you don't have the opportunity to go back and do a second take. So you have to get that right then and there. And you have to know what you want and you have to go get it. And so I think that was great preparation for Mapplethorpe.
I want to play a moment from the film. This is early on in when Robert Mapplethorpe meets Patti Smith. Of course, they have an enduring relationship, which you get at in the film. And it's early on in their experience together when they're she's just at this particular moment. I want to play this because I want to talk about this the relationship they have and their kind of the aesthetic that they shared and the love that they had. I thought this is a really interesting moment when they're together early on, and they're together in bed. She's just read him some of her poetry, and she's asking him, as you hear in this moment, what he thinks. And the response in this interchange I wanted to ask you about. Here's a moment from the film.
What do you think?
It's great.
Yeah.
But I wonder if they'd get it. Everyone. Everyone else, everyone who's not us, I don't think they see the world like we do.
Our world knows me.
Our world. Yeah, nobody lives there but us, right?
Right.
Like it, yeah. I told my parents we got married in a strawberry field in California.
What?
What?
Why'd you do that?
It's a beautiful picture. Don't ever leave me, Patty.
One of the things there's a lot in that moment. One of the things I wanted to ask you about is his idea of people aren't going to get it. And this goes to kind of the visionary quality of his work and the fact that he was very much on the edge of his artistic aesthetic. And that not everyone who's not us, who doesn't sort of inhabit this world, is going to understand it or get it. Would you talk to me a little bit about that? Because that seemed to be one of the things Patti Smith and Robert Mapplethorpe kind of shared.
Well, I think that's really what brought Patti Smith and Robert Mapplethorpe together, was that they were able to see things in a certain way. They shared vision. They shared an appreciation of what each of them was bringing to the world, and didn't feel understood by anyone else. And not that there weren't leagues of people that would come to embrace them in the future, but it's sort of that young, undiscovered feeling that if you're an artist, you know it. You know it, and I know it. And I, you know, as an artist myself, obviously infused the script with some of my own experience, where it was like kind of me coming up in documentary and going, I don't think people understand just how fascinating real life is and real life can be. And I think they're thinking that you have to make it up, that we have to make things up for it to be interesting when, oh my gosh, real life is so fascinating. And I feel like Robert was grappling with that and more. That was the surface. People won't get it. They won't get it. They won't get me. They won't love me. They won't understand me. I mean, of course that attraction was still to men was still happening within him. Then it was just more latent and just not yet full bloom. And he loved Patty. And I think that, you know, sexuality is on the spectrum, obviously. And so he really did love Patty and was attracted to Patty, I'm sure. And all of that, but that was inside him. So when he says, you know, they won't get it, they don't see the world like we do. He knew early on that he was going to have to, like he says, I think there'll be some traces, you know. He always had this feeling that he would make a mark on the world. And he always had this kind of conviction that it was going to be something that was against the grain, I think. And he also knew he would die young. I feel like by, you know, we're looking at a lot of different artists, but looking over time, people know like we know things, because part of being an artist is being in touch with an intuition deep inside oneself. And the more that one can trust that intuition and kind of follow it, even if it doesn't make sense, even to us at the time, that's how greatness happens. You know, that the more that we do that, the more potent our work will be. And so it's about drawing outside the lines and even sometimes drawing in the dark when you can't see the paper, you know?
Let me play another moment. This one of the things that you've talked about being sort of relating to Robert Mapplethorpe is how the camera was this bridge, as you've talked about, into these other worlds. And there's this moment when this artist that he meets at the Chelsea Hotel, he and Patty, you know, Sandy Daly, gives him this camera. And at this particular moment in the film, she's showing her some of his work, and they're sort of comparing. This is before he started taking photographs. He's been just sort of constructing these collages. He's still trying to sort of figure out his art. And their conversation is interesting. I wanted to play this this moment and talk about it.
Oh,
yes, I see.
That's better.
This is potent imagery.
Thanks.
You really should take your own pictures. Why don't you?
Printing, reprinting, the darkroom takes so much time. You know, I can't just be Mapplethorpe the photographer, you know? I want magic, majesty. I want to be a modern Michelangelo.
And you think if Michelangelo had a camera, he wouldn't have used it?
She tells him that that it's about the light and that it takes talent to find this and see it. Talk a little bit about how you relate to Robert Mapplethorpe in that you see this camera as a way in, because Robert Mapplethorpe clearly saw this as a way into this world.
In my experience as a filmmaker who was set out to document life as it was unfolding, the camera became part of my right arm. It just literally, I didn't put it down. From the moment I picked it up at 19 until I had a baby at 30, I remember thinking, oh my God, I just put the camera down because I have to pick up this baby. And it was kind of revelatory to me. Oh my gosh, I've just spent a decade of my life holding a camera, and that camera has led me into worlds I could never otherwise enter. And I just couldn't, because the camera's a bridge. The camera gives us permission. It gives us some safety. It mediates our experience. It's exciting. It's a powerful tool, a camera, because the people on the other side of the camera are suddenly having their lives matter, like, because they're being documented in some way. So that's alluring, yeah. Because in our nature as human beings, we want our life to matter, our lives to matter. We want to feel like this multicolored, overwhelming, magical, death-defying, crazy experience called life is not a blip, that it doesn't mean anything, nothing, you know? And so I feel like a lot of our motivation as humans is to leave a mark of some kind or feel like we are. With Robert, it was also really important to him that he left a mark, and that mark was historical, and that mark was not like any mark that had preceded it. There was nothing interesting about doing what had been done before. Nothing remarkable and nothing worthwhile about that. So he saw an opportunity. I mean, there was a world that we couldn't even bear to look at, that he could get into from behind a camera. And the sort of, that's that kind of that dungeon scene that you see where he's in that empty pool with those, you know, men in leather. He's able to kind of flirt with them from behind the camera, and it's safe. It's safe there, you know? And he doesn't even have to know he's gay yet, necessarily. He can still go home to Patty at the end of the night. So,
yeah. Well, let me play this moment, because I thought this was interesting. This is where Robert is telling Patty, as you'll hear, that the photos he's been taking, he is drawn to them and that he can't stop himself. And of course, Patty has an inclination. It's one of the first things she asks him is he gay? And he says he's not, or at least he doesn't. But this idea of him being unable to stop himself, and how Patty sees now these photographs that he's taking of men, she's going to have to compete with that. And she sort of knows where she's going with all of this, but let me play this moment and we can talk about it.
Look, I find myself wanting to touch them and take pictures of them.
But you can't take enough pictures of me.
You're your best, Silky. I love taking pictures of you, of course, but it's just, I can't stop myself.
Guess I always knew I didn't want to.
Yeah. Nothing's gonna change. I'm not leaving us. Ever. What are you doing? Hey, Patty, what are you doing? You can't leave. This is our world. What about Mutt and Jeff and Ricky and Lucy, Ratso and Joe?
I'm not leaving, Ben.
Patty, please.
Stop. No, you can't leave.
I'm not leaving the solar system, Robert.
You are the solar system. This is the solar system. You can't leave.
Yes, I can't. Get a grip.
Please. No, but you don't. Patty. If you leave me, then I'll become gay. I will.
Well, so be it, but I gotta take care of myself, okay?
Don't go.
What does he mean? If you leave, I'll become gay.
I think he meant that she was the only woman he would want to be with, and that after that, yeah, it was going to be the end of him having one foot in what was acceptable in society and being able to keep up appearances with his family and being able to be accepted he still had that option with her.
Yeah.
And it was going to be over.
Yeah.
And he literally did say that. I mean, that comes from the Patricia Morrisroe biography, Mapplethorpe. So.
Yeah. There's this scene where his brother, Edward, comes to see him, wants to at first write about him for a school paper and then work with him. He wants to be a photographer too, like Robert. And Robert shows him the photos that he'd been taking, these raw, explicit, you know, homoerotic photos. And it's an interesting scene because, and we see this sort of throughout, that Robert insisting that people acknowledge this as his aesthetic, that these are the images that I want to take. They're raw, they're explicit, they're graphic, but you have to take it or leave it. And there's another moment I wanted to play from the film and have you talk about, where Sam Wagstaff, who sort of becomes his mentor and lover in the film, they're meeting with this woman at an art gallery, and she says she loves the rawness of his work, but she's like, I can show your celebrity photographs. I can show the photographs of David Hockney and Deborah Harry and Arnold Schwarzenegger, but I can't show them all. And that's unacceptable for him. Let me play this moment.
These photographs are exquisite.
Yes, they are.
Precise, uniquely scintillating.
Thank you.
But I can't put little Jesse McBride, Philip Glass, and Arnold Schwarzenegger next to cocks and chains. I'd have to pass out Valium at the door.
Show all of my work or none of it.
I want to. You are brilliant. You're the Jekyll and Hyde of photography. But the public won't be able to handle it all at once, dear. My clients are only just beginning to grasp that photography is art.
Yeah, see, Holly, Robert doesn't have a lot of patience
for anything.
Yeah, I have an idea of how Jekyll and Hyde can both have their debut simultaneously. I'll call you. You're going to love it.
Can't wait.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about that, would you? That he had this uncompromising view of about the way his work was presented. And that's that thing that Sam Wagstaff mentions there in the film, a real impatience.
I think as soon as he could see where we should be and how beautiful that world was, he couldn't stand the lag that society had in seeing it his way, which is part of what drives him and part of what makes him impossible and part of what it takes, I think, to turn things and to kind of push the envelope, you know? I think as an artist, you know, it's that impatience, because if he was just like, la-di-da, la-di-da, you know, everybody will catch up. This will be a gradual thing. Let me just have another, you know, it's fine to split it up. And, you know, he wanted to be fully accepted and fully loved for who he was. And he wanted, he was not going to settle for less than that. And I think without Sam Wagstaff, you know, not only getting the Hasselblad, but also really helping him to navigate that world, that art world. We wouldn't know Robert Mapplethorpe today. I think a lot of people would agree with that. Not that he would be any less talented. It's just there's a lot of really talented people that don't have that kind of access and don't have a patron and a father figure to guide them through, like Robert was so lucky to find in Sam.
Andy Timoner, she's a filmmaker. Her new scripted feature film is called Mapplethorpe. Tomorrow night, the Utah Film Center is screening the film at 7 o'clock at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center here in Salt Lake City. Timoner will be there for a Q&A after the film. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
KUER's community of sustainers do so much for the station. Because of their ongoing contributions, we're able to bring you award-winning local news, NPR coverage, Radio West, and our own podcasts. Starting at $5 a month, you can be a sustainer too. Then, next time you hear a story you love, you'll know you made it happen. Become a sustainer at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the photographer Robert Mapplethorpe. His explicitly sexual pictures became a part of the culture wars of the 1980s. The director Andy Timoner's film about Mapplethorpe premiered at Sundance this year. It's being screened tomorrow night. She joined us last week to talk about it. There's this other aspect of Robert's life that you've talked about also kind of relating to, and that is the part of him that was raised Catholic. And there's this moment that he has with one of his first lovers, David Crowland. It's one of his first intimate encounters, and Robert is sort of tripping on drugs at this point too, and says he doesn't want to be doing this. And there's this moment I wanted to play from the film where he talks about how beauty and the devil are the same thing. Let me play this moment because I want to ask you about it.
Beauty and the devil are sort of the same thing to me. And he's always been with me. Like, always. I guess in church, I found God. And then when Sandy gave me the Polaroid, it led me straight to the devil. And now, suddenly, I'm f***ing my f***ing devil. I guess you could say I have a certain Catholic aesthetic.
What does he mean that the devil's always sort of been with him? And how does he draw that distinction between God and the devil and the way he, you know, created his work? Do you think you understand that as having been raised Catholic? I'm wondering if you can connect with it in that way.
Yes, I think that you can't take the Catholic out of the boy, and that without the church, we wouldn't have Robert Mapplethorpe either. I think that the church and the iconography therein is absolutely vital to all of his work. And it colored everything. He was an altar boy. He loved the aesthetic of the church. His mantle, you'll see in the film in the 80s, populated with crucifixes and skulls and religious iconography. He definitely saw beauty and the devil as the same thing, because what he found beautiful was going to lead him into a life that he knew would be full of also tumult and pain and isolation, because being gay then did not mean what it means now. And we're very lucky to be alive now, because it was not easy. And I think, you know, the reason I wanted to put a little bit of real footage in there and archival, and just a little shout out to Ronald Reagan as we move to the 80s, is just to kind of recognize that and say, look, this is the time, Stonewall, you know, this is the time. Mm-hmm. This is a time in history when these things, these rights and this kind of acceptance that we take for granted didn't exist. And it was peaking through, but it was really a tough time. So yes, beauty and the devil were the same thing. And he felt he was making a deal with the devil, and he made his peace with that. And I think that also had to do with how he handled AIDS later, you know, which is a very controversial part of the film, part that I didn't expect the Robert Mapplethorpe Foundation to accept as much as they did, which is that Robert knowingly spread the disease, knowing that he had it. He continued to sleep with people. I don't know whether or not that was partially because he felt he made a deal. And, you know, he says, you can cheat life, but you can't cheat death. So he makes a choice that he's going to just live while he's alive, and assumes that everyone understands the risks at that point in time. And I think that's partly him feeling like he's made a deal with the devil a little bit.
I wanted to ask you about Milton Moore. There's this black African-American model that Robert Mapplethorpe is attracted to, meets on the street, convinces him to come and takes his images, takes photos of him. They become some of the most famous, iconic images of Robert Mapplethorpe. But the way you explore the relationship between Mapplethorpe and Milton Moore is really interesting. And how conflicted Milton feels. Is he being, exploited? Is he just, as he says in this clip from the film, is he just a nude piece of black meat? Let me play this moment because I want to get your perspective on this.
Whoa, take it. What are you doing to that? No, stop it. Stop it. What are you doing? I love you.
Love me?
Yeah.
You don't love me. You don't love anyone. You love yourself. And how you make people do shit. You make me do shit. You read crap I don't get.
Okay, take it easy.
You call me nigga in bed.
Milton, come on. That's just a tease. It's not meant as an insult. I thought you liked...
Oh, nigga who poses like a new piece of black meat for his pansy boyfriend. You.
Oh, take it easy. Okay, Milton, I was trying to enlighten you, to celebrate you, to celebrate your strength, to celebrate your beautiful black flesh.
I'm not take one of your white boy stuck-up sculptures.
Milton,
I... Shut up, ain't nobody's nigga.
Okay, all right. Milton. Milton. Milton, you have been the subject of some of my best work. You are the star. Milton.
You took pictures of my dick sticking out of my pants.
Because it's gorgeous. Milton.
You picked the wrong poor black boy for your collection.
Talk to me about this relationship as you saw it, as you wrote it. There's that part of Robert Mapplethorpe that wants to possess that, that might exploit his subject. And I mean, this was a really, I have to say, powerful moment. Just talk to me about the way you were thinking about this as you were writing it and thinking about it.
I think that what happened with Robert is that he became more and more like the frames he created. He was going for complete perfection, and he wanted everything to line up. And so he went for perfect frame, perfect form. He wanted Milton to be perfect. He wanted him to be well-read. He wanted him to know Shakespeare. He wanted him to be able to dance. He wanted to turn him into something that he wasn't because his body was so beautiful. He wanted everything else to happen in that way. And that is obviously horribly damaging to Milton and very upsetting. And, eventually Milton breaks. There's something very predatorial about Robert as he progresses into, the last decade of his life. And also very vulnerable. He has a great need for love and connection, but he goes about it by trying to possess people and drives them away eventually. And also just, it's a restlessness that happens, I think, for him as well, where nothing quite lives up. And I got to say, with Matt, he was never quite satisfied with the performance. He was never quite satisfied with anything. And I think he was able to pull on that to really bring Robert forth in the 80s. So, and that character forth in the 80s.
Robert Mapplethorpe is at the end of his life. Of course, he's dying publicly. You see it. And one article I read about Mapplethorpe said that he basically was kind of orchestrating his own exit. And it seems like that's what's going on. I wanted to talk to you about those final days as you were thinking about he's resigned to his fate, as you show in the film, and he's trying to perceive he wanted. I guess what do you think about that idea of him orchestrating his own exit? That's he did want the final scenes to play out the way he had envisioned them. I guess.
I think when you're an artist, you see everything kind of from inside your body and in through your eyes, and then also from a third person perspective, you know? And I think that he felt really, really disappointed that he was going to have to die at a time when he had just attained mainstream success and where you weren't really famous unless you were photographed by Robert Mapplethorpe, and just to have to be taken out, you know, at 42 years old is just so tragic. I think he wanted to mark it just like we talked about earlier. You know, he wanted to make sure that he threw his own party. He had a champagne party at his house. He had that right. Whitney retrospective, which was so satisfying to him. And at the end of the day, he wanted to control everything he possibly could. He could not control that he was going to die, but he was going to control as many elements around that passage to the next world as possible.
There's a moment from the film I want to play, and I want to ask you about this. This is a moment when Robert is dying. His mother has sent the family priest to see him. And the exchange that he has with Father Stack is interesting. Let me play this moment. I want to ask you about it.
Robert, do you believe in God?
No.
What gives you solace?
Beauty, perfection, knowing that I've captured those things in my work. Knowing that my work will outlive me, it will still be there when I'm gone.
And you have.
Thank you. That's what I see.
Even that which we deem obscene, you make look more beautiful than I thought possible. I wonder what it's like to be your subject.
My subject?
And there's this moment when he takes photographs of Father Stack. What would you talk about? There are a couple of things in this scene that I wanted to ask you about, but that moment when he takes a photograph of the priest, would you talk about that moment from the film?
Sure. I feel like the tables turn. And that there's a fascination that Father Stack actually has with the imagery that Robert has created and collected. Yeah. And I particularly made a meal out of, which we're on a radio show right now, so you can't see it. But visually, Father Stack is really taking in the mantelpieces and the shelves that Robert has populated with religious iconography, with sexual imagery and photographs of bondage and S&M. And so we get to see Robert kind of sneak up on him like this shark quietly in the water. Even though he's on a cane, he's walking silently in his monogram slippers, which is really true to Robert. He had those monogram slippers. Yeah. And it's this moment where he catches the priest, in a way, his childhood priest, red-handed. Holding one of those pictures in his hand, looking closely at it. And then the father goes on and really, as we just heard, is very complimentary to Robert and sort of wants in on the collection. You know, he wants to know how it feels. And I mean, it's a little bit of poetic license for sure, how that all goes down and what happened. But it's just a wonderful moment, I feel like, for the audience. It's a bit of a relief. I feel like it's playful. And, you know, Robert was playful till he died.
Yeah.
I was speaking with Faye Gold in Atlanta. Faye Gold Gallery handled Robert's work back in the day, and she was photographed by him, and she was telling me about him. And she was saying that he would literally, you know, he's on a feeding tube for months, 6 months or so. But he would just want people to come in, and he would want to exchange funny stories and laugh. And he was still laughing, you know, he was still joking around till the end. And so I think this was a moment where it just becomes kind of, I now have you in my grips and you're in front of my camera and
yeah.
I can ask you anything. And he provokes him. And Robert was very much into being provocative, quietly provocative. So I feel like, yeah, a lot of his personality shines through in that moment. The devil's inside all of us.
Yeah.
You know, where is it inside you? I mean, challenging the father like that, and the father's stuck on a stool and can't move because he's requested this session.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a scene I'm very fond of.
He says in that scene, knowing that my work will outlive me, what can you say about Robert Mapplethorpe's legacy? It seems fairly certain that it has, right? Does his work... Has it outlived him? Does it still persist as you think about
it? Oh my gosh, yes. I mean, Robert Mapplethorpe is bigger today than he was yesterday and will continue to grow sort of like a fine wine or something in value. I mean, you see that a little bit in the movie where he says, you know, 25,000, you know, 50,000, his value's going up with every pound of flesh he loses, you know,
he says.
So the sicker people could see and smell that he was going to die. And as soon as they understood that, he already was getting money, and he loved money. He loved to get money because he didn't come for money and for other reasons that I can't account for because I don't know him personally, but he loved money. And he was bequeathed money by Sam Wagstaff, who died before him. But he was really... I mean, that's how he had that opulent loft at the end. But he was really starting to get to gain value in the art world. And with The Perfect Moment and all of that controversy in 1989 upon his death, and that he witnessed a little bit of before his death, he gained real notoriety. And they say, you know, there's no such thing as bad press. Doug, just the other week in Portugal, his show was kicked out. And the gallery owner left. But yeah, he has shows all over the world. I mean, massive, massive, massive shows all over the world at all times. There's always a traveling exhibition. I mean, something like The Man in the Polyester Suit, which is the Milton Moore shot that we show in the film, you know, that he takes when he convinces him to unzip his pants that first night. That's, you know, that's easily $500,000 in value.
Wow.
Yeah.
You have said that you want the film to be, as you put it, an anthem for artists, something that inspires people who make art not to compromise. Let me ask you that finally. Are you seeing that? Do you worry about that when you look at artists, filmmakers, and other artists? Are we compromising too much?
Wow, what a great question. I think there's always a tension between art and commerce. I think it's the golden age, certainly in documentary, it's the golden age now, and there's more independence and freedom than ever with the amount of outlets that need content like Amazon and Netflix. And, you know, there's a lot more desire and hunger for content, but there is always going to be this tension where the money that is provided is going to have the final say in many cases, or the network or whatever. And a lot of times to make something quote commercial, actually Madeline Olnick and I were just talking about this, that she was saying, like, to make something commercial, especially when it's about a gay subject, to make it more general is often the way to go. But I mean, I think it's a really interesting concept that somehow if we make the gay character more like an everyman and less specific and less unique that it becomes somehow the idea is that it's more embraceable. And I'm very much of the opposite mindset. I believe the more specific and the more intimate a portrait, the more relatable, always. So the more that one can feel for the young Robert inside the older Robert, or the, you know, understand where he came from in the church, or these kinds of things, the more specific to Robert's experience, the more that we're going to understand and have these kinds of tethers that we can form between ourselves and this protagonist, as counterintuitive as that sounds.
That's Andy Timoner. She directed the film Mapplethorpe. The Utah Film Center is screening it here in Salt Lake City tomorrow night. That's at 7 o'clock at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. Andy will be there for a Q&A after that screening. She's also joining us tonight. She'll be along with the filmmaker Madeline Olneck on stage for a Q&A talking about the challenges of making films about historical figures. That's also at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center, and it's also at 7 o'clock tonight. You can get details about that on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Tim Slover. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.